Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast in which we discuss the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films of all time. Before you go any further, be warned, what you're about to hear is riddled with spoilers. We suggest you watch the movie before listening to this podcast.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
All right, Top 100 fans, thank you again for listening to our podcast. We appreciate it. Before we get into the Philadelphia story, let's answer last week's Coming Attractions trivia question, which was for Fantasia, and it was this. On the list of top box office hits, when adjusted for inflation, there are three animated films ahead of Fantasia. They rank 10th, 11th, and 18th. What are those films? Bev?
Okay. Snow White?
That's 10th.
Bambi?
Nope.
Toy Story?
Nope. One is one I would never have gotten if I didn't see this. The other one I probably would have if I gave it some thought. So Snow White was correct. That's 10th. 18th was The Lion King. Probably not a huge surprise there, you know.
Yeah.
But number 11 is 101 Dalmatians.
Say what?
Yep, the 1961 animated dog movie. Yep.
No way!
There it is.
Wow, there has to be some kind of explanation for that.
People wanted to go see it over and over again, I guess.
People really like Dalmatians.
It was either that or go watch the Jets and the Sharks snap their fingers and pretend to kill each other. A slam of West Side Story months before we even get to it. All right, then. So motion picture number 26 in the Top 100 Project is The Philadelphia Story. It was 51st on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list between From Here to Eternity and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, but went up a tidy 7 spots to 44th on the second list in 2007 between Midnight Cowboy and Shane. The Philadelphia Story was released by MGM the day after Christmas, Boxing Day if you're Canadian, December 26, 1940, but got a full release about a month later in January. The movie was well liked by ticket buyers and made a nice chunk of change at the BO. Bev's going to tell us the skinny.
About to be married socialite Tracy Lord, played by Katharine Hepburn, deals with a reporter, Jimmy Stewart, and her ex-husband, Cary Grant, invading her home, one looking for a story and the other looking to win back his woman. Tracy bounces between all three men until the romantic pieces fall into place.
The movie in a nutshell for the Philly Story. Heiress picks alcoholic ex over weenie Pris and toothpick-shaped member of the media.
I'm not shaped like a toothpick, I'm very manly.
Weenie Pris. That doesn't seem fair.
Oh, they make it pretty clear from the first scene. He's weenie.
Ah, I root for George in a way.
Wearing his riding outfit, yeah? Okay, Philadelphia Story. I was going to say that this is a textbook example of Hollywood product. It's efficient, it's charming, it's occasionally funny. I wouldn't say it's often funny. And it's a pleasant two-hour diversion. But we've been talking about it a little before we even sat down to record our podcast. We have different thoughts. So what did you think about the movie overall?
Well, kind of like Gone with the Wind is a movie that at first glance I really enjoyed. Like you say, it's highly amusing. It had a couple of great laugh out loud moments. There's plenty to admire and enjoy about the movie, and it's great Hollywood fare. Like you say, it's efficient. There's really not a lot of wasted time in it, and the performances are incredible. The script is so clever based on the play. Mm-hmm. But it's colored. It's impossible to watch it and not be troubled by the pretty profound sexism in it, especially because it's a really big part of the story. A big part of the story is that this woman starts off being kind of proud and competent and headstrong, and the great finish of the movie, like the happy ending, happens when she bends, when she gives in, when she goes back to her clearly abusive husband.
Because at the time he was an alcoholic, which apparently he's sobered up.
Yeah, but
doesn't excuse it.
Yeah,
but...
and he doesn't seem remotely repentant for the way he behaved. You know, there's a line where he's bantering back and forth with Mike.
Mike played by Jimmy Stewart.
Yes, and she's there and he says he thought all writers drank excessively and beat their wives. And then he looks at Tracy and says, at one point, I wanted to be a writer. And he doesn't seem sorry. He never seems sorry for the way he treated her.
It's a clever line, but it's not a very nice line.
No, it's not a very nice line, and it's repeatedly implied that it's her fault. It's her fault that he was mean to her because she was this impenetrable statue. Because, you know, he was only attracted to her because she was a challenge and she could never... What does her father say? Her father says, "You have everything it takes to make a lovely woman except the one essential, an understanding heart. And without that, you may as well be made of bronze." It's this criticism that's repeatedly piled on her by her father and by Dexter. And she, not, I don't want to say she resents it, she's hurt by it. Even though it's not exhibited ever to be true about her, because she actually is warm and caring. She cares about her sister, clearly, and her mother. She certainly is, I guess you could call her bossy, but she's kind. She's kind to George, who, like you said, is a weenie, you know, you can't mount a horse. He comes from new money, even though her family comes from old money. She doesn't judge this. She seems to love him anyway. She has all these kind of kind, admirable qualities, but the fact that she isn't forgiving, she doesn't have an understanding heart, she's not a pliable woman who will let these men in her life get away with whatever they will. Like, her father straight up blames her
For him messing around.
For having an affair on her mother. He straight up says, "Oh, I think that men cheat on their wives because their daughters aren't sweet enough," or something to that effect. It's a truly heinous scene, but then what's even more heinous is that that scene changes her and changes the outcome of the movie to what's implied to be a happy ending, that she takes it to heart and then goes back to her ex-husband, who's we know has abused her in the past. His intention for coming to the wedding was kind of revenge in the first place anyways. It's even hard to see that he wants her back.
And he's bringing in the reporter and the photographer from Spy Magazine.
Yeah, he's actually doing a pretty terrible thing. He's lying in order... He blackmails her because she's proud and she wants to protect her family. So he blackmails her with this information about her father to get reporters to her wedding, which she vehemently... does not want.
And they get to stay in her house, which is a very interesting twist. And I don't think you'd see that too often now. And the irony of that is that they say at one point, essentially, Dexter is the Sean Penn or Alec Baldwin of the 40s because he's smashing reporters' cameras. And yet here he is palling around with a reporter and a camera person, camera woman.
But he'll chum with them to get revenge on his ex-wife.
I think he's in love with her still. And I think that there's enough of him that is sincere, but he does give her a pity wed.
It's just not romantic at all.
He only proposes to her because all the guests are waiting for the marriage to George, and all right, well, let's get married after all.
It's so strange when she and yet
Jimmy Stewart
marry
does
him,
it
yeah.
first. Mike says, I'll marry you,
and he's actually in love with her, and another great example of how she's not actually this hard, unforgiving person. It says that she seems to be falling in love with Mike, with Jimmy Stewart, because he is a great writer, even though he's not necessarily successful, and she seems to admire him, and she has fun with him, and she never is seems to be passing judgment on him. All these criticisms that they have of her are proven untrue. I've been thinking about it a lot, and we can also talk about how this movie was, in a way, her big attempt to get back into Hollywood. Mm-hmm. She, at this point, had been called box office poison. Bringing a Baby was one of a few flops that just about ruined her career. The playwright who wrote this play wrote it specifically for Hepburn to play this role.
Yeah.
So there's some implied, I guess, collaboration. And then she bought, with the help of Howard Hughes,
which we learned from The Aviator, she dated him for years.
Yeah, and with his help, she bought the rights to make the movie from the play, and she, of course, had some control over it.
A lot of control.
Yeah, right.
For an actor, a lot of control.
Yeah, exactly, and so she is really responsible for the message of this film, and I was thinking about it. On one hand, it's her contrite way to win back the audience, like, look, you're going to see me get knocked down a peg or two.
Literally pushed down by my face.
Literally, yeah, the first scene you see her and she's pushed down by her face. And all these people kind of like knock her down to size. But then when you read in that further layer, you see their criticisms aren't fair. She is a nice person. She's just, you know, kind of bossy and headstrong and proud.
She's her own person.
Yeah, she's qualities that are unattractive in a woman. And I wonder if there's this kind of entreaty to audiences to take her back and that she's sorry and she's learned her lesson. But in further subtext in the film is her being like, but this isn't fair. This isn't fair to me, and what you all think of me isn't really fair.
That could very well be true. This is the third movie we've now seen the project that I can think of with an heiress as a major character.
Oh,
it happened one night, Gone with the Wind, and now this. And they're different types
isn't
of movies.
Isn't it also in Bring Up Baby? Isn't she wealthy?
I suppose so.
Is it her father that's the benefactor, or she merely has some influence over the benefactor?
Okay, we'll say that one then too. Yeah. So there's two with Hepburn. Mm-hmm. But the ones I was going to say, though, three different kinds of people, Claudette Colbert in It Happened One Night, and Vivian Leigh in Gone with the Wind, and now Hepburn in this. It's the ultimate example of a movie about white people problems.
Oh, yeah, big time.
We've seen some really important movies the last couple of films, Gone with the Wind and Grapes of Wrath, with deeper issues. Gone with the Wind has a lot of flaws, as we pointed out during that podcast, but it's about the Civil War, it's about Reconstruction, it's about starvation.
Yeah.
It's about, well, they don't really address the racism, but it's about that too, and the sexism. Grapes of Wrath is about even more serious things, a lot of those same issues.
Mm-hmm.
And they're based on classic books, and they're revered.
You could certainly call that like an important film. It's an important film about people, a story that's important to be told.
Mm-hmm. And this one, despite people's love for it, is not.
Part of it is just the pleasure. What's the line they say early in the film? What's prettier than seeing pretty, privileged people enjoy their privilege? Something like that. They state it right early on in the movie.
It's a good line, and I also love Charlton Heston's quote about Cary Grant during the AFI special. He said he got to wear beautiful suits and say beautiful things to beautiful women.
And that's kind of fun to watch, as much as it's fluff, and I get it, but yeah, I think Woody Allen said it too when they asked him why he's always casting these beautiful women against him. Like, why doesn't he cast more realistic women as his love interests? And he's like, nobody pays money to see average people on screen. There is something when you're looking at a screen that's several stories high. You know, you like to see pretty people. You like to see pretty places. It's just kind of adds to the enjoyment of it. Is it right? Probably not. And it's definitely a very good thing that we also have films like Grapes of Wrath. And it's important that those movies get made too. But when you just want popcorn fluff, well, there's something to be said for just watching, yeah, beautiful people in beautiful clothes and beautiful houses with white people problems that are of low stakes. Yeah, it's fun.
Okay, the ultimate example of white people's problems would probably be if they own a boat. Because they must be doing pretty damn well if they own a boat. So, trivia question numero uno. What's the name of Dexter's boat?
They say it more than once. I think it's the True Love.
Oh, yes it is.
Yes!
Well done. So let's talk about the cast with the three big stars and everyone else in the movie too. You've got Hepburn, Stewart, and Grant. Giant names, big stars. They already were and they became bigger later. Stewart was still kind of building his legacy, I suppose. He'd been in some big movies in a couple of years in a row. You Can't Take It With You in 38. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in 39. And other movies, Destry Rides Again had been in 1939. That was pretty popular. And then Philadelphia Story in 1940. He would win the Oscar.
Yeah, this probably cemented his stardom.
His only ever win in that category. And he interestingly thought he was miscast and that he won the award as a make good for Mr. Smith. And he was disappointed that his friend Henry Fonda didn't win for Grapes of Wrath. Which,
yeah, he voted.
I would agree
he
with
he
all
voted
of those
for
things.
Henry Fonda. Yeah, I agree that Henry Fonda's performance, it's really good. It's pretty hard to deny that it would be a harder performance to pull off. And that's part of why he would have deserved it. But at the same time, Jimmy Stewart is so great in this movie. I find him so fun and charming. I didn't love him in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, you know that. But I really enjoyed him in this. His charm, like, I felt like him and Hepburn had a great chemistry, more so even than she had with Cary Grant.
You thought she should have ended up with Jimmy.
It seems as though they are leading up to that, like, it's a perfectly obvious foregone conclusion. When that scene, when she's at the library and he finds her there and she's been reading his articles, I think, and they have that conversation, they have that moment, it's like, oh, well, obviously they're going to wind up together, and then they have the whole drunken night at the pool, and, you know,
which is a rarity for her. She's not a lush.
No, they say it's the second time she's ever gotten drunk, and the first time she also, you know, misbehaved herself and let her goddess statue queen exterior, you know, show cracks in the veneer. And she obviously does it that night too, and that really wonderful scene where he's carrying her back from the pool in his arms, singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow from another MGM movie. I guess they didn't have to worry about paying for the rights for that song. And that great moment where she greets everybody. Hello, Dexter.
Hello, George.
Hello, Mike. And just the way she says it, you're like, oh, she's crazy about him. Obviously, now that she's drunk, her defenses are down. It seems so perfectly obvious that that's who she should end up with. I was so surprised. I remember the first time I saw this movie years ago, I was just shocked. Like, I couldn't wrap my head around how she could have possibly ended up with, to me, was the villain of the movie. I would have been happier if she had wound up with George. He was dull, but at least he was nice to her. At least he clearly was in love with her and seemed to be the only, much more than Dexter at least, love her exactly for whom she was, knowing, kind of accepting and loving that she was this strong, proud, smart woman.
They'll always say, back in the old days, that these kinds of films, romantic comedies and screwball comedies, were comedies of remarriage. And in this case, that's literally true.
I thought that it was just a subgenre of screwball comedies, a comedy of remarriage.
Well, that's what some famous film critic came up with, and I think as an explanation for what this kind of thing is. Remarriage, not necessarily in the way that someone actually was married to the other person before. Usually that's not what that means, but it's more about how you meet and there's chemistry, but you're not together yet, and then there's something that happens and there's a breakup. It happened one night, does it exactly well, right? That does it perfectly. Colbert is supposed to be marrying somebody else, and then she realizes she's fallen in love with Clark Gable, but then she thinks that he's walked out on her, and then she's going to marry the guy after all, and at the last second, things work out. So they weren't married before, but that's the comedy of remarriage.
That they're together, right, they go apart, and then they come back together.
Mm-hmm. And this movie does that exact same thing, only were married before, so they really are literally getting remarried as an instant last second, I got to marry somebody. How about
God
you?
Forbid.
No, wait, no. You, Jimmy Stewart, you should marry the photographer you've not made any eyes at this entire film.
Yeah.
Her interest has been in you, granted, but Mike has not shown any interest in Liz.
They should have just cast the very same actress that they got to play Saunders in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, because she's exactly the same. She's, you know, this kind of witty career girl with really great hats who's... has this unrequited love for Jimmy Stewart, and he realizes at the very end.
Well, the ending is debatably bad, debatably good. I suppose if you're a big fan of this movie, you're going to love the way that it all works out. And if you're more like us, where you respect the movie but don't love it exactly, then it's going to be more a matter of pointing out the flaws, as we've been doing. And there's another flaw in it, and that's for Tracy to break up with George because he questions what she may have done with Mike the night before. The whole, hello, George, hello, Mike. Mike did carry her into her bedroom. But that just proves she's looking for excuses to break it off with George.
Isn't there a line where she's mad at him for not taking advantage of her the night before?
Could be.
I think there's something like that.
But my point is that she's remarkably immature about her impending marriage to this guy the very next morning. If she's going to break it off.
Her behavior is very suspect, like, towards George. For her to carry on the way she does the night before. Yeah, it definitely implies that she isn't ready to marry George, and she shouldn't. No matter how much she insists she's in love.
And part of the reason that people who are big fans of this movie, and there are many big fans of this movie, no doubt about it, excuse the Dexter behavior. When we see him push her down by her face in the opening scene, when we hear about him being, I don't know if they say abusive, but I guess it's implied that he at least wants to be abusive, and he was an alcoholic.
Did he sock her in the face?
Right, the sister, Dinah, asked that. You loved that quote, didn't you? You said it before it even came up.
Over and over again. It's just so hard to wrap your head around how the attitudes have changed so much that something like that back then was played for comedy.
But I think people excuse it because it's Cary Grant.
I guess so.
If it had been Bogart, as big a star as Bogart was, actually wasn't yet. He's in a few AFI movies from now, in The Maltese Falcon, which was his big breakout. He'd been in other movies before where he'd been very good and got great notices, but that was the one that made him a star. But as big a star as he was and as well-respected as he was going to be, if he had been Dex in this movie and did everything the same way that he usually did them, then it would have been harder to have sympathy with this guy being somebody who isn't just abusive. And incidentally, of course, Bogart would play with Hepburn in a future AFI movie, The African Queen.
Mm-hmm.
But as an example of somebody who maybe couldn't pull off the role, as well as Mr. Charm, Cary Grant could.
Well, he didn't charm me. I think the fact that the first scene you see with the two of them is him pushing her down. And of course, it's played for comedy with the musical accent.
She did break his golf club.
Oh, for God's sakes.
All right, well, let's get, again, back into the stars and the supporting cast, too. So we said that Hepburn had major power. She actually had veto power on the cast, the director, and the screenwriter. The director was George Cukor. We'll talk about him in a second. And the screenwriter was Donald Ogden Stewart, who was adapting the play. He said something about how it was the easiest job he could ever possibly have. He thought the play was perfect.
He won the Oscar for the screenplay. And he won the Oscar, yeah.
Now, this is the last time that Hepburn and Grant would work together after, I think it was four movies, and obviously Bringing Up Baby was one of those. So with this being his last time working with Hepburn, it was interesting that he took the less juicy role of the two men. He took Dex over Mike, because he ended up being the only one of the four main cast members who didn't get an Oscar nomination.
Oh, yeah.
Hepburn, Stewart, and Ruth Hussey were all nominated for the Oscars, but not him.
What a fool.
Well, he was pretty successful at that point. I don't think he had too many problems. And he also, he did have some both selfish motivations in his role in the film and not selfish motivations. The selfish one would be that he had to be top billed.
Yeah.
And the non-selfish part was that he gave a lot of his money, in fact, maybe even all of it, to the British war relief effort. Because, yes, of course, they were in the war at that point. Yeah. America was still literally a year away, I guess. And we're talking the end of December 1940. Let's get into the supporting cast then. So you've got Ruth Hussey is playing Liz.
Mm-hmm.
Solid performance. Not a great one, I don't think. But,
yeah, it's fine. But
did a good job. The one you like, Dinah, the Diddy
She's
Soccer.
Great.
Virginia Wheatley, pretty good. Typical kind of kid acting, which is almost irritating at every moment.
Ah, she won me. She won me over, and I'm not easy to win
Boys of that
over.
Era. Boys of that era were almost always irritating.
When it comes to kid actors, I am with you. Like, it's pretty hard to tolerate them very often. But she, this scene where she comes in with her point shoes on and that ridiculous necklace that she's wearing, and then she sings the Tattooed Lady song. It's just hilarious. She really pulls it off. I thought she was, like, delightful, despite her unveiled enthusiasm for spousal abuse.
And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, as far as supporting performances go, John Howard played George, Mr. Buttoned Up. Doesn't really get many laughs. He's got to be the straight man and play kind of a lame role, but he... But he pulls it off. And then Roland Young got to be Uncle Willie, who was the opposite.
Yeah.
He got to play a fun role in his supporting...
The other kind of unaddressed bit of weird behavior towards her... She's got her cruel philanderer father,
and
her perverted uncle.
Who grabs her butt in the first time we see them together.
Niece. Mm-hmm. There's so much wrong with that. But they're just like, isn't that cute? Isn't he just adorable? I'm like, keep Dinah away from him.
He's probably doing the same thing to her.
Mm-hmm.
Although she's not nearly as attractive as Miss Hepburn. Who I don't think is all that attractive, but...
You take that back.
But a great star. George Cukor. Let's get into him. The director. Finally, he gets to direct an AFI movie.
I wrote down the same note in my notes. We finally get to see a movie that he both started and finished.
Yep, it was Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind. He was a part of those. Not such a big part of Wizard of Oz. Gone with the Wind was more of his movie for quite a while. But now he finally directs a full film. And he still has one more to come. And that would be My Fair Lady from about 25 years away from now. Cukor had worked with Hepburn before, and he would again. Adam's Rib, Pat and Mike are in their future. We're not going to review them for this project. And both of those films co-starred Spencer Tracy, who would, of course, become Hepburn's longtime co-star over and over again. They're in an AFI film together, also in the 60s. That would be Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. But this was a fast shoot, and much like with Grapes of Wrath, where John Ford got through the production very speedily, and they got the movie out pretty quickly after the book had been released, Philadelphia Story was shot in the summer of 1940. It came in under schedule. And then the film was released 4.5 months after they wrapped. So that is impressive. You don't hear a lot of under schedule, under budget in the modern era. Clint Eastwood, they talk about that a lot with him. But generally you hear about how it is. And reshoots aren't necessarily an indication the movie's not good. Peter Jackson did a lot of them in the Lord of the Rings movies, and they ended up being giant hits and great films.
It's a way to spend money, though.
But it's almost always something that people would think, oh, what's wrong with the film? Just like if there's ever a delay in when they release it.
Mm-hmm.
If they say it'll be released 5-6 months later, it's got to be bad.
Yeah.
But you get movies like Philadelphia Story and the Clint Eastwood movies of the modern era and many other movies from the old era that didn't have that. And generally you think, okay, they got it right. And one more thing about the behind-the-scenes people was the producer was Joseph Mankiewicz, and he would go on to direct an AFI-er, All About Eve, and a very infamous non-AFI-er, Cleopatra. He was a pretty good director, but yes, he started as a producer. And that was an interesting thing, too. Not everybody did this, but an awful lot of people had to learn the craft of directing as a producer first. And it was like, you do the job that actually has more power before you do the job that is more recognized but has, in a way, less power.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the people that learned his craft that way. He would direct many years later. All right, so let's do at least one more trivia question before we end it up here. What is Tracy's middle name?
Tracy Lord. Gosh, I don't even remember hearing it.
They do say it.
I can't. I don't remember.
Samantha.
Oh, okay.
Breaking news. Trivia's been harder the last couple weeks than it was the first couple weeks with Die Hard and Wizard of Oz. They were the first two that I ever found trivia for. And what did we have? 4 in the podcast and another 5 or 6 online. It's been harder the last few weeks. Okay, so before we get to the awards, here's an interesting point that promos next week's podcast, which will be... Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, number one on both lists.
Right. Hepburn's co-star in the play was Joseph Cotten. He played Dex. Mm-hmm. And who is in our next top 100 movie but Joseph Cotten playing Jed in Citizen Kane. Knowing him, he was a good actor. He worked with Wells quite a few times. I don't think he would have been anywhere near as... There you go. I mentioned about Bogart. Maybe would have been an interesting choice for Dex and the wrong choice for Dex. It would have been harder to sympathize with mm-hmm. him being a tough guy. Cotten as well. Not a tough guy, but not somebody who's inherently sympathetic the way that Grant is and likable and charming and... So there you go. There's an example. Stewart thinks he's miscast in this movie. Whether we agree or not, he thinks that. And Grant is perfectly cast in this movie because for the role to work that you don't even like, mm-hmm. You probably would have hated it if it had been someone other than Cary Grant.
Well, I wasn't fond of it. I know I keep criticizing it, but I would like to reiterate that I did enjoy the movie. And that if you can watch it in context and with, like, a critical mind to the messages portraying, it is still a really rather delightful movie to watch. It is funny, and like you said, it's just...
I think it's sporadically funny.
Yeah, but it has all those elements of a great popcorn movie that it's just so amusing. It's just so fun to watch, and the performances, and I cannot praise the script enough. There's so many great, witty back and forth between them, whether you're laughing out loud. It's just so fun to watch these great actors say these great words, and I understand why this script Oscar went to this screenwriter, even though, you know, of course he just pretty much copied the play. And you could, I even thought it as we were watching it, and I didn't know that it was based on a play, but you can almost tell just by the, because playwrights just value language more and performances, and it was such a huge, huge part of it, and that makes it really fun to watch. Like, I wouldn't not recommend this movie to people, especially anybody who's media savvy enough to kind of pick up on how strange these things look to a modern audience. But I think there's probably very few people that wouldn't find it strange. It's because times have changed so drastically. While it colors the film, I still would recommend this to people.
Yeah, I've seen it in the movie 3 times. In very different eras. Would have seen it in 98. Saw it again probably 3 years ago. And now here, and never loved it any one of those times. It's grown on me a little bit more. What you talked about so much earlier in the podcast about the sexism and the implied or otherwise spousal abuse. The movie is going for comedy, and I don't really dwell on that the way that you do. Maybe it's easier because I'm a guy and you're a woman that you'd notice it more and care about it more. Not that I excuse the movie for those things, but when you're going for comedy, unless it's really cheap that you're playing off of some offensive notion, if you're using racism, for example, as purely for comedy, if you're white people making fun of blacks or making fun of some other race, then that's a bit of a cheap shot. But then again, if you make it funny, then it's funny. And if the movie is, in this case, is delightful and charming and works for people, then that's all it's trying to be. This is the most shallow movie we might have for quite a while now.
Oh,
the 40s have some pretty deep topics, or movies that may not be hugely deep but are just beyond great.
Well, I do have to just state for the record that I disagree that just because they play it for comedy that they get a pass on espousing unethical ideas and ideals. I mean, people used to think that The Party was a pretty funny movie, but I think just about everybody finds it offensive when Peter Sellers doing the Indian face, whatever you would call it, the brown face. It's an offensive movie.
Yeah, you think Borat is very funny, and that movie is making fun of idiots, American, generally Southern idiots.
And it caught a lot of flack for it, too. But you're right, I do love that movie. It does crack me up.
We will excuse things if they make us laugh.
Damn, you got me. You cornered me. Poor, that's so funny, though. Damn it. Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe it's unethical for me to like Borat. Like, maybe I should be more offended by Borat. I probably should.
You can make anything funny if you find the right way to do it. I think you can make literally anything funny. It doesn't mean that in the end you're going to feel good about yourself if you really analyze why you laughed. But funny is funny.
A lot of the scenes where the sexism occurs are not comedy scenes, though.
Yeah.
The stuff between her and her father, that's not comedy. Her winding up with Cary Grant at the end, that's not comedy.
Oh, I think that it's supposed to be.
It is?
She loses one husband, and about 3 minutes later, she's proposed to by another guy. And then about 40 seconds after that, she's proposed to by another guy.
Yeah, but they could have easily just turned that around between Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant and had her end up with the kind reporter. And it still would have been the same
thing. Then why was Cary Grant ever there in the first place?
To incite the action. He is the instigator of all the shenanigans in the first place. And then it could be even funnier that he instigates this action in a way to win her back, maybe, and then winds up driving her into the arms of the reporter that he snuck into
her
house.
That would be interesting, yeah. That would give the movie more depth than it probably has.
I win. Point, Ellis.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, a third trivia question. The mother's name is what?
Oh.
First name, obviously. You can't say Mrs. Lord.
Mother. It's mother. She called her mother.
Margaret.
Oh, it's Margaret. Ah, I read that, Marge. Too. Curses.
Okay, so the awards and other AFI lists. The Stewarts won Oscars, as we said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy and Donald Ogden wrote the script. It was nominated for many others, but it just won those two. It was on the National Film Registry in 1995, and it made three other AFI lists. It was 44th on the Top 100 Passions list, 15th on the Top 100 Laughs. That I take issue with. It's not nearly that funny. That is one of the worst AFI lists of them all, incidentally, mm-hmm. the Top 100 Comedies, because there are so many movies that I and many other people think are hysterical that weren't even recognized. I don't know if they were even nominated.
Mm-hmm.
The Coen brothers in particular had, I think, maybe one. I think it was just Raising Arizona that was on there.
It's a bias against younger movies.
And the other list it was on was fifth in the rom-com category of the Top 100 Genres.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so 51st, 44th of the two lists. What are your thoughts on that?
I think, you know, even take away my issues I have with the gender politics of it, I have the same issues you have. I just don't think it's not innovative enough. It's not funny enough. It certainly has lots of components that work, but considering some of the omissions on this list.
And people didn't make movies based on Philadelphia Story. They weren't influenced by it.
No, it was already a well-established genre. You know, they weren't reinventing the wheel here, not even close. It's a well-executed film, but
not a great one, though.
No, I would take this rom-com off, replace it with When Harry Met Sally.
Mm-hmm. Interesting choice. I know many of your friends would agree with you.
I love that movie.
So our fourth trivia question is the coming attractions bonus, which will be answered on next week's podcast. Hepburn wanted Clark Gable to play Dex, but of course he didn't. How many films did Gable and Hepburn make together? We will not answer that now. It'll be leading off next week's podcast.
I'm going to pretend I know the answer to that question, and I'm just holding off on saying it.
And speaking of next week's podcast, we've already mentioned it. It is the two-time AFI champion. Drum roll, please. Ding! Citizen Kane.
This is going to be a hard one.
Yeah, there are so many things to say about this movie, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners have seen the movie. They must know about it at the very least. And so, God knows, it'll probably be a long podcast. I'm going to tell you right now, before we even talk about this next week, the greatest commentary I've ever heard on a DVD, Roger Ebert, we mentioned him again, the commentary he did on Citizen Kane. I learned so much by listening to that commentary. I think I've heard it three times over the years.
Mm-hmm.
This will be the first time in a while we've seen a Blu-ray. I got this movie for my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't watched it yet. We saved it for now.
Mm-hmm. Looking forward to that one, for sure. That is a great movie. All right. In the meantime, for more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com, where you'll find reviews and more trivia for The Philadelphia Story, as well as other movies that we've reviewed on the Top 100 Project. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, or you can find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com, and you can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
One last trivia question. Where does this movie take place?
Yes!
Slam dunk.
Oh, nailed it.
And cut.